Nearly 70 years ago, my parents-in-law, Esther Rose Buckwalter and Ronald Graber, graduated from Goshen College with high ideals inspired by their faculty and by their families. Among their professors and parents and grandparents and aunts and uncles and cousins were many missionaries and pastors and church leaders, as well as those who had asked thoughtfully during their early years, what sort of life's work is God preparing us for? What gifts do I have? And what are my deepest passions, and how might those direct my vocational path and contribute to that work? During the summer of 1952, just after their college graduation, as they were planning for their August wedding, Anne and Sybil's future dad wrote to their future mother, "We're going to walk down the aisle together and go out to try to make a difference." They were seeing their lives through a theologically framed lens, understanding their calling to be directed toward having some impact on the world. As you heard in the children's story, in addition to his family and college mentors, Ron had been among those who'd been forever changed by that summer, 1946, three-week passage across the Atlantic on a horseboat destined for those in Poland who'd lost everything in the war. It seemed a simple task, but it opened a window onto the world for Ron. There, also as a 16-year-old, he encountered, as Ed indicated, broken people and destroyed homes and schools and public buildings. Distributing horses to those who had almost nothing left seemed too small, too insignificant in the midst of such a loss. Ron returned from Poland, headed off to college and then medical school, then spent his professional life serving as a surgeon at a small Mennonite hospital in Aibonito, Puerto Rico. He'd been influenced by faithful role models, had listened to those he'd encountered in his early life experiences, and had prepared himself for a life of service. I begin here because, well, honestly, I didn't know where else to begin. In the week since Anna asked me to speak in this Epiphany series about revealing God's love through sharing our gifts, which I agreed to do as a kind of quid pro quo for Anna speaking in my congregational ministries class. That's it. Don't worry, though, it was a perfect call, and I've been fully exonerated. I've experienced undue anxiety about speaking on this topic, or perhaps just preaching at all. Maybe I've just been off the homiletical horse too long, I thought. But then there also was the brain-confounding, world-misaligning reality that I wasn't asked to speak about sexuality. My usual sermon fare and the topic about which I most practiced. And then, to make matters worse, my friend and former colleague, Bev Lapp, who claimed in her sermon 2 weeks ago to not know how to preach, spoke eloquently and wisely and with incredible Thomas Bona guffaw-inducing jocularity, humor, for goodness sake, in a sermon in this series that veritably left me in tears. And they weren't even good tears, but stress tears. How could I follow that? So I turned to the commentators, hoping they might give me some hermeneutical hope. I mean, what could be simpler in a series on offering our gifts than the biblical charges, "You are salt of the earth, and you are the light of the world"? Until I realized that the rest of that passage says, "But if the salt loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It's no longer good for anything except to be thrown and trampled underfoot." And that, of course, is the part that the commentators latched onto with vigor. W.F. Albright wrote, "The saying as it stands in our English version makes no sense at all, in spite of all the efforts of the commentators," apparently the other commentators. "Sodium chloride," he said, "does not lose its taste or savor except by dilution. Furthermore, though salts of various kinds are necessary to the fertility of the soil, over-salination can and does effectively render land infertile, as evidenced by the ancient primitive actions of sowing an enemy's land with salt, as in the treatment of Carthage by the conquering Romans in the Second Punic War." Well, of course, the Second Punic War, which happened just over 2,000 years ago, as Paul Keim said after he read a draft of this sermon, "Who needs such modern references as the Second Punic War? The practice of over-salinating an enemy's land is mentioned in the Hittite and Assyrian texts from the 2nd and 1st millennium BCE. So, and as if that weren't discouraging enough, Albright says, "There's no conceivable manner in which salt can be resalted once it has been diluted." Well, there you go. So many of you already are experientially aware, no doubt, that too much salt in the diet can lead to high blood pressure, thereby increasing the risk of heart disease and strokes. So there are risks in using too much salt, or perhaps in being too salty. And as I reflected on that notion during my sleepless nights of non-sermon preparation, I realized that my preaching anxiety was further exacerbated by my own vocational saltiness of late. I teach in the Bible and Religion Department at Goshen College, a department that had 65 majors and minors a decade ago, but now has only one major, though she's a darn good one. She's here today, too. And about 10 earnest minors whom we also love. Over the course of the last decade, a series of cultural winds has buffeted essentially all religion departments, the humanities in general, across the country, leaving them under siege. Young people who watched their parents endure or lose jobs or be underemployed during and since the recession of 2008 have turned in droves away from the humanities toward less risky disciplines that lead to financial security or professional jobs immediately after college life. Simultaneously, on our campus, the percentage of Mennonites, the students who in the past were most likely to consider Bible and religion or peace, justice, and conflict studies, has precipitously dropped, as it has at all of the other Mennonite colleges and universities, leaving us in religion with a smaller pool from which to draw. And young college-bound people who've grown up in congregations that rejected gay and lesbian and genderqueer friends often have been repulsed by the church, all while coming of age in a country where the most outspoken Christians are evangelicals who elected to the presidency a prevaricating, women-assaulting, amoral narcissist. They're Cyrus, they intone. And then those same evangelicals have shrugged, even cheered, as that vulgar, vindictive president has lied thousands of times more and debased our collective sense of decency, not merely by giving the Presidential Medal of Freedom to an unapologetic misogynist and racist this week, and pushed policies that further destroyed God's good earth and worsened climate change and caged immigrant children in spite of, Scripture's call in Isaiah 58 and elsewhere for loosening the chains of injustice and caring for the earth and sharing food with the hungry and clothing the naked and providing the poor wanderer with shelter. For God's sake, in that world, who really wants to be associated with religion? Or at least, who really wants to be a Bible and religion major? Too often in our educational institutions, fragile as they are, there's not been a recognition that we need now more than ever alternative visions of what it may mean to be religious, to follow after Christ, to stand in a faith tradition, or to think critically about faith, that we might need visions of the biblical texts that call us towards something more noble, a narrative more enlivening, a way of life more filled with integrity and authenticity, that we might need to understand the complexities of our own religious background as well as those of others in order to more thoughtfully navigate the world we are entering. And so, for several years, I've watched as wise colleagues, ones fortunate enough to have been affirmed in their teaching vocation, to have had lives of meaning and service. I've watched as they have, one after the other, painfully limped away without a safety net, without clarity about a legacy, without closure. So yeah, that's created some vocational angst for those in our discipline. Does what we do matter at all? I'm sure others of us could tell considerably more painful stories, ones where we didn't have a sustained run at using our gifts, stories of lives unfulfilled, aspirations unpursued, gifts unrecognized, callings unaffirmed, or vocations squelched. For some of us, the demands of life, of making a living or caring for aging parents or children, of tending to our own or our companions or our adolescents' physical or mental health needs, or essential tasks that are part of running a household or living responsibly, they squeeze out every ounce of energy we have. Sometimes the press of life reflects choices that are actual expressions of our callings, and that's good. And sometimes those obligations distract us from our yearnings. And for some of us younger folks among us who haven't ventured far into any sort of life calling just yet, some of us have wondered what we will do with our lives, to what and to whom we'll be committed, where we will expend our primary life energies, what relationships we'll form and lives we'll touch, and perhaps what sort of volunteer or paid work we'll do. That's worthy vocational reflection. Two rather traumatic incidents shaped my early years and helped define my sense of self, my perception of God's grace, and my particular vocational and religious passions. The first incident occurred when I was in an accident with my grandparents and other relatives. My great-grandmother was killed in that crash. My grandfather, teenaged uncle, and his cousins all were ejected from the car with exotic combinations of broken legs and arms and ribs. And somewhere in the car's spinning, I, a one-year-old infant at the time, was catapulted through an open window and then over a fence and 30 feet farther out into a bean field. Those on the scene first couldn't locate me until they heard me crying. And when they found me amidst the beans, I had only three tiny scratches across my forehead. 2 years later, I nearly drowned in a well on my aunt and uncle's back porch. As a three-year-old, I was curious about the round wooden cover on the porch floor, so I pushed it back and peered into the darkness it covered, sealed, and then I tumbled into 6 feet of water. I was drowning. And fortunately, lying on her belly, my aunt could just reach the tip of my middle finger as I stretched it out of the water. In rural Kokomo, Indiana, it seemed everyone in my home community, salt of the earth folks certainly, and yes, that phrase does come from that Matthean passage, everyone knew about these incidents. So I grew up hearing the dramatic tellings and retellings of these narratives of my early life. I felt a little like the forehead-scarred Harry Potter. Who knew from early on his destiny. I know now that hearing those stories repeatedly during my childhood and adolescence gave me a strong and passionate sense of purpose and a deep appreciation for God's goodness. I now struggle with nearly all of the theological assumptions of that narrative, given the reality that not all children who fall in wells or who fly out of car windows live. But I know that those events gave me an early embodied sense of a gracious, protecting God. I knew God's grace in my unbroken bones and air-filled lungs. Hearing about those brushes with death also gave me a commitment to serve that God who I was certain then had saved me. By my early teen years, my passion was clearly for some sort of ministry, broadly defined. I wanted to do something with my life that mattered, something that made a difference, a claim than any of us can make, no matter what our vocational direction. All I needed yet were some gifts that I could use in ministry. One of the most foundational periods for my later vocational discernment came during my sophomore year of college when I lived about 5 years of life in 1 8-month block, a period filled with both tragedy and joy. The turbulence began when I left for a 6-week backpacking tour of Europe, my first extended spell away from home, my first time on an airplane. While in Italy, I got a glimpse of Christian faith in the early centuries, a high-octane Christianity that indelibly etched people's lives. I prayed in the underground catacombs outside Rome, where early Christians met in secret, fearing for their lives, but desperate to worship nonetheless. I saw the Roman Colosseum, where our faith ancestors suffered for their convictions. It was tremendously moving to visit these sacred and terrible sites. The month after my return to the States in early March, I experienced a lung collapse, a pneumothorax, and found myself hospitalized for several days and in bed for a number more. It was an all out-of-the-blue malady, probably related to a congenital defect in my lungs. Later that spring, I experienced sophomore uncertainty, a disease that sometimes strikes college students. I was asking all sorts of vocational questions, uncertain of what I wanted to do with my life. Should I continue with school if I had no idea what I wanted to be when I grew up? I returned home in May and began working for my brother-in-law and his family in their construction business. Not long after I began doing carpentry, about 2 weeks after I started, my sister left her husband with whom I was working. That made my ongoing employment awkward, though I stuck with it throughout the summer and into the fall, skipping a semester of school. I know now that I am a college professor partly because through working in instruction, I realize that unlike Jesus, I have almost no carpentry skills. Failure in that arena drove me back to school where I'd been more successful and where I'd experienced much energy and joy. But out of the crucible of that year, the intellectual and emotional and physical and spiritual wrenching of my being, I made a forward commitment of faith, an adult decision to follow in the way of Christ. I'd been baptized much earlier at the age of 12 in what I've sometimes described as my breech birth into the reign of God, scared butt first into God's embrace. At that pre-adolescent point, I'd only been frightened of death and post-death destiny. My same-age cousin had died tragically just months before. And so I'd made faith commitments to save myself from something. And now in college, I was making a forward-looking commitment to be a disciple of Christ, though I scarcely knew what that meant. At the same time, I began to sense more clearly a calling to and a desire of ministry of some sort, whether in pastoring or writing or teaching or whatever, a commitment that continues for me. I believed then that my life's work had to be in the service of Christ and the faith community. Construction could be in the service of Christ and the broader community of faith, too. Look where we are in this space. As can be accounting or art or owning a business or working in a factory or serving in a nonprofit agency or doing maintenance work or being in the healing professions or nearly any other role. For me, I realized that for the development of my own gifts, which did not involve working with my hands, I'd need to complete my formal education. So I returned to college and completed my undergraduate degree. After school, a job fell in my lap. I began working as a journalist, editing and writing for two newspapers over the next 2 years, believing journalism was a worthy profession in an almost post-truth world, as Barb and Wilma so eloquently said with the lighting of the peace lamp. It's perhaps more worthy now than it's ever been. But I also knew that my life would likely yet take some other turns away from journalism. A few years later, I became co-pastor in my home congregation. When a vacancy opened, the congregation tapped me on the shoulder and encouraged me to study alongside doing half-time pastoral work. And I began an elongated 5-year program at what's now Anabaptist Mennonite Biblical Seminary. After nearly 4 years pastoring in Kokomo, I became interim campus minister at Goshen College and also taught English and communication courses that year. I remember telling my mother one evening that I was going to go back to school to do a PhD in religion, and she paused, and being a woman of many words, God bless her soul, my mom's pauses meant something. She paused when I told her I was going to do doctoral work and then said, "Well, okay, as long as you don't turn out like one of those weirdos." That was my parental blessing for PhD work. And then eventually, after completing my doctoral degree, I moved into teaching the Bible and Religion Department at Goshen. It's clear to me now, looking back, that each of these specific work settings prepared me for the next, that they wove themselves into a kind of tapestry of a life. Each stage contributed to the following one, allowing me to test and hone certain skills that I still use today and what genuinely has felt like the place where I should be, the place where God has called me to serve as a disciple of Christ. My current struggles in that teaching work are knowing when I should stop. My biggest fear of the last decade has been having people say, at the point I choose to retire, sheesh, he should have retired 5 years ago. I've been trying to discern how to stop at the sweet spot, not the oversalty one. Many of us in our congregation are teachers throughout the various levels of education, or teachers in our congregational context. It's been clear to me over these 3 decades of teaching that it's a vocation that is not for the faint of heart, nor one for those who need instant gratification. Teaching is always an act of hope, because so often we don't see the rewards and the impact on our students until decades later, if at all. That's why sometimes in the summer I like to paint our house or the front of our shop downtown, since painting is a craft where you get to see immediate results. I love that. When we teach, we wait for the surprising little affirmation, the trust that allows one we've taught to be vulnerable with us in their brokenness, an unexpected but warm handwritten Advent note wishing us well, wedding invitations or adoption or birth announcements that suggest those years of teaching about healthy sexuality had some influence. Invitations to ordinations or doctoral graduation ceremonies. The words of gratitude penned by an alum or a parent grateful for a reference or for mentoring. And on good days, we realize how much our students regularly give back to us and give out to others with their engaged curiosity and profound insights. In a recent interview, comedian Jim Carrey was asked how he wanted to be remembered. Carrey said simply, "I don't care if people remember my name. I want what I do to mean something now. I care that the people I came in contact with maybe were a little bit freer or a little bit better or a little bit happier, and that they then did something for somebody else and it spiraled. We can each in our lives affect so many people. So that's all I'm after. And I think it's the little bit that I'm after too, as I think about my life and work. Shining a light to help some others find their way, just a bit. Walking alongside some students who choose to continue standing in a flawed but graceful faith tradition. Helping people think more constructively and critically about their ethical foundations and theological convictions. Developing and affirming the skills in some who go on to do great things." And it was as I wrote those last words that I remembered with gratitude that many years ago, in my initial iteration at Goshen College as a communications and English prof, that I taught speech. And in that first speech course I taught, one of my young, most promising students was none other than Bev Lapp. So now, as I reflect back on it, rather than stressing me out, it warmed my heart to hear Bev's eloquent sermon, for which I would like to claim about 80% responsibility. Some years ago, while a graduate student in religion at Harvard University, Mary Moshella gave Harvard's baccalaureate address. In the speech, she notes that she and her colleagues were drawn to the university because of a modest desire to learn to see everything clearly. "We came to explore the very mysteries of God, to expand our view of the world and discern what it is that the universe demands of us," she says. And then Moshella tells a story that speaks eloquently about little surprises and learning to see anew and discovering a vocation. She says, "Last summer, I was in Israel working on an archaeological dig. At the site of the ancient city of Dor, each day as I swung my pick into the age-old soil, I was inwardly chipping away at issues of personal faith and belief and the global issues of human struggle, militarism, racism, sexism. I expended a good deal of energy cursing the facts of human suffering in the world and trying to imagine some kind of hope of restoration. Excavating at the level of the Iron Age," she says, "can be rather tedious. Only rarely do we turn up any precious small finds. Most of the time was spent staring at dirt walls and broken pottery shards. In my square, not even one whole vessel was uncovered all season. Just so many pieces, scraps of ancient civilization. All of the brokenness appeared to me as an accurate metaphor for understanding the world. Broken and crushed, every piece of it. Broken with small personal pains as well as with overwhelmingly large human struggles. Yet as the summer went on, I kept staring at the pottery. I slowly started to notice something more than just the brokenness," she says. "Some of the pieces of clay, however broken, were really quite beautiful. Later in the summer, I found out about the business of pottery mending. This tedious work goes on year-round in a cathedral-like building not far from the Tell. Here, ancient vessels have been slowly and carefully reconstructed. I remember being completely amazed at seeing those huge restored jugs for the first time. How could anyone have possibly managed to piece together so many small, nondescript chips of clay? Seeing those restored vessels," she said, "encouraged me to imagine, perhaps, that at least some of the world's brokenness could be overcome. I began to picture myself in a kind of vocation of mending, of repairing some of the world's brokenness. To mend the world, says Michelle, to proclaim a radical vision of social transformation that would prevent future brokenness from occurring, these are the tasks that I perceive the world to be demanding of me. End of story. I began this morning, and it was a long time ago. It's, as the old saying goes, few people are saved after the first 15 minutes of a sermon. So this was risky. But I began this morning with a story about my father-in-law and his brethren's service committee trip to Poland after World War II, a trip he shared with Ed and with Al in our congregation. Some 50 years after Ron's post-war service on the horseboat, an Eastern European man came to visit Ron and Esther at their home in the hills outside of Ibonito, Puerto Rico. The visitor was a financial consultant based in San Juan and was assisting them with setting up their retirement plan. While talking with Esther and Ron, the consultant noted over the fireplace this plaque, which says, Danziger Feuer Societate. As a 16-year-old, as I said, Ron had picked up the fire station marker from out of the rubble of a bombed Danzig street. Ron explained to the visitor that before he went to college, he went with Brethren Service Committee to take horses to Poland, distributing workhorses to people in need. And the face of the visitor from half a world away, a visitor had come to their home to serve them, began to tremble. With tears in his eyes, he said, our family received one of those horses. It was all that we had, and it's the only reason we were able to survive through that winter. You are the salt of the earth, and you are the light of the world. With both salt and light, we don't need too much, but just a bit will flavor our lives for the better and help light a possible path for those we encounter, keeping them from stumbling or illuminating the way for the next phase of their lives. We won't know it right away. We may not live to hear it from everyone whose lives we've touched. But committing ourselves to using our gifts to train and serve and think and heal and facilitate and clean up after and learn from and mend others in the Spirit of Christ makes a difference in our world. Those are expressions of our true vocation as disciples of Christ. Amen and amen.